there's no better feeling than a personal win. And the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
This episode is brought to you by Bai. It's Wonderwater. What makes Bai so great? It's simple. From Raspberry Lemon Lime by Sydney Sweeney to Zambia Bing Cherry and Palavo Pineapple Mango, Bai has antioxidants, electrolytes, and no artificial sweeteners. So for flavorful hydration, choose Bai. It's Wonderwater. Learn more about Bai and discover all of the exotic, bold flavors at drinkbai.com.
Hello and welcome to the Game Theory Podcast. I'm your host, Sam Vecini. We are presented by The Athletic. Today on the show, Adam Spinella is in the building. Spins and I are going to break down a few different topics. We're going to talk about the four NBA play-in games that we've seen from the Atlanta Hawks and Miami Heat, the Oklahoma City Thunder and New Orleans Pelicans, the Los Angeles Lakers and Minnesota Timberwolves, as well as the Chicago Bulls and Toronto Raptors. Then we are going to dive into the Dallas Mavericks and their decision to tank the last few games of the NBA season. It seems like the league is taking a look into this. Adam and I kind of want to look at a few different angles on it and decide whether or not it was the right call, wrong call, number of different factors I think worth considering here. Finally, we're instead of talking about NBA draft prospects in 2023, given that we're going to do that quite a bit here moving forward on this show, especially on the Monday episodes, Spins and I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the players that have already removed themselves from the 2023 NBA draft process and will instead look to try their luck in 2024. That will include Kyle Filipowski, Donovan Klingon, Riley Kugel, guys like that. Guy, by the way, did you hear what I did there with the OWs? Adam,
no,
Kyle Filipowski.
Oh, we're in it.
The Pittsburgh is back in me after spending a couple of days there, and it's tricky to get rid of. I'm gonna have to get back to those OWs very strongly here. Kyle Filipowski, not Kyle Filipowski, for the people who have been around Pittsburgh enough. They know what's going on. But what's going on, Adam?
Hey, Sam, it's great to see you here. I'll be honest, I don't know what day of the week it is anymore. Like, it's what a weird kind of long weekend with a little bit of a holiday here, some days off from work for me. Like, we're just getting through and powering through this thing. NBA playoffs are on the horizon this weekend, which gives us something to look forward to. But a lot of news and movement in the college basketball world as well, yeah. Which means every day is an exciting one. Portsmouth Invitational starting this week. Really fun time for hoops.
You're heading to the Portsmouth Invitational. You will be the Game Theory correspondent at the Portsmouth Invitational. I'm out here in LA. I've done draft workouts the last couple of days. It's been really exciting to sit down with some really, really interesting players that you guys will see features on in time. There's one particularly that I'm really, really excited about that I'm going to write here probably within the next month or so. But really, really excited to have been out here. It was great to get back in gyms. Like, you get to be back in the gym all the time with your kids in high school. Man, it was so good to be back in gyms. Yeah. I just love it. I really loved getting to see these guys work out, shoot around, develop. It was funny. I was talking to someone over at P3. Because I went up to Santa Barbara yesterday and we talked about the idea of the NBA draft process just being aspirational by nature. And it really is. Like, I really genuinely love the NBA draft and I genuinely love talking to these kids and being a part of that process just because it is kids achieving their goals. It's trying to maximize their potential, trying to help these kids get the information that allows them to maximize their ceiling and allows them to be in a position where they are very, very positively impacted. So I'm really, really excited about this upcoming draft process. It was really, really nice to go up and kind of talk about that. It is genuinely why I love the NBA draft, the aspirational ideal of these kids just achieving everything they've wanted since the time that they were 10 years old.
Yeah. Well, and then they even take that a step further as NBA fans and people who get so involved in this process pre-draft and watch them coming up from high school and to college and all of their improvements that they go through, to then watch them turn into grown-ass men and adults in the league who continue to build upon the skills that they've shown, get better, impact the game at the highest level. That's where this really comes to fruition, and it feels like a fulfilling process. Even if you're just the smallest part of it, you're in the gym watching them, you have one conversation with a guy, you end up really rooting for him and wanting to see his success. And that's where it tends to be really fulfilling on that back end.
Yeah. And, you know, over the last, you know, 5 or 6 days, or really over the last 2 days, particularly, I've done, you know, sit downs with 6 different prospects, and it's been really, really fun to get to know them and talk to them and get a chance to really understand what they're about. You know, one of those kids I talked to today, for instance, was Olivier Maxence Prosper, Omax, from Marquette. I was blown away by Omax, to be completely honest. Like, he is one of the more just intellectually curious, emotionally intelligent prospects that I've gotten a chance to talk to, you know, over the last few years, certainly. He was so, so impressive. He was so, so impressive sitting down and talking to him, talking about just like the different schemes and different coverages that Marquette utilizes, and talking about, for instance, we had like an extended conversation on his incredible performance against Jordan Hawkins in the Big East tournament, where he chased Jordan Hawkins around screens constantly. And just his strategy is like a 6'8" guy with a 7'1" wingspan chasing guys around. It was such a good, and look, like, I don't mean to single him out. It's just like, that's one guy that was awesome that I talked to. I talked to so many really, really great people over the course of the last couple of days. It's so good to be a part of this process. I genuinely love it. But let's transition now to some of the guys that have gone through this process previously and are achieving success. I want to start with Oklahoma City, to be honest. Oklahoma City beats the New Orleans Pelicans 123-118 yesterday in their play-in game. And they are now set for a date against the Minnesota Timberwolves to be able to try and make the playoffs as a rebuilding team in the NBA playoffs. And man, I love this. Look, I've been clear. Oklahoma City's been one of my 3 favorite teams to watch this year. I love this team. Shout out the Kings. Shout out the Knicks. Those 3 would be my favorite that I enjoyed watching more than anybody else. But I so enjoyed watching Oklahoma City beat New Orleans yesterday. They're tough.
Yeah.
They're skilled. They're long. They're big. They're athletic. They're grimy. Like, they are tough dudes. I tried to tell people up in Santa Barbara that I was with yesterday, guys, like, Josh Giddey's exploits in Australia at like U18 underage tournaments, but when he was just like an up and coming prospect before he got to the NBL as a next star, they're like the stuff of legends. Like, this dude is not going to be in any way flustered by any moment that he gets thrown into within this setting. And man, that dude was unbelievable last night. Dropped 31 points, 9 assists, had 10 rebounds. And I thought he was the best player on the court, if I'm being completely honest. Shout out Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. Unbelievable player. No disrespect. Shai is the best player between any of those guys. But like last night, for those moments, with the way that he dictated that game, I thought Josh Giddey was the difference for the Oklahoma City Thunder. What were your thoughts on the Thunder Pelicans game?
Yeah, so Giddey, absolutely unflappable in those moments. And I'm glad you brought up his pedigree and kind of how he's been built for that moment, because so many times we want to pick apart a lack of playoff experience and say, I don't know if the Thunder can make it past this point because nobody on their roster has really done it before. They've got a bunch of young guys who've never been in this situation. But when you draft for competitiveness and when you draft for high IQ and character, those are the guys that you trust to go to battle and just roll the ball out and say they're going to be the best version of themselves no matter how bright the spotlight is. And it was a great first step to see the Thunder bring that to fruition by playing as well as they did against the Pelicans and just being in attack mode throughout the game. I thought, you know, Giddey and Shai Gilgeous-Alexander as two different lead ball handlers, they provide so many different things for the Thunder offense. Giddey is this bagless wonder who just like finds ways to get to his spots and make the right play every single time. And then Gilgeous-Alexander is the guy with the turbo pack who can just live in the lane whenever he wants and is so fast and aggressive and really, really good at finding any hole in the defense he can to just punch through it and get into the lane. Those two are relentless over the course of a 48-minute game. And I thought the Pelicans' defense really wore down as the night went on because Oklahoma City wants to play with pace. The way that they just inbound the ball, even after a made basket from the Pelicans, trying to hit it up the sideline and go a little bit faster. All of that stuff and the residual effect over a long game, it wears on you. And this Thunder team has no back down in them. I absolutely love their kind of collective grit and identity. Think you muted there, Sam.
Yeah, like they're just huge. They play big. Yeah. Like that's the thing. Like Josh Giddey is 6'8", 6'9". Shai is 6'6", but with his wingspan, he plays bigger than that. Lu Dort plays bigger than 6'4". Like this team is very difficult, I think, to match up with across the positional spectrum. And they really let their starters go last night. Like, yeah, you know, Aaron Wiggins played 14 minutes. Lindy Waters got like a little run in the second quarter, right? But when you're that big, I feel like it's just really, really hard to match up with you over the course of a game. And they're not overly big at the big position, but the other guy that stood out for me was not the Jalen Williams that's going to be a finalist for Rookie of the Year.
No.
It's the Jalen Williams that plays center for this team as a rookie. And man, unbelievable performance, I thought, from Jalen Williams. Jalen Williams went 1 of 7 from three. The shot was not there for him last night. But man, the passing, the playmaking, the defense on the interior, I thought, was quite strong given what he was asked to do within that game. Across the board, they were just a monster. Yeah. When he was off the court, it felt like they had no answers. Like anytime Dario Saric was in the game, it's just like it felt like the Pelicans got wherever they wanted. It was absolutely remarkable, I thought, to watch Jalen Williams just be as impactful as he was throughout the course of that game.
And it's such an important piece for the Thunder because while they're big at so many of the guard and wing spots, they have played really small on their front line all season long. And if you're going to play small at that position, you need to both play fast and effectively be able to spread teams out. Now, a lot of times we just think of spreading you out as being based on three-point shooting. And the fact that Jalen took 7 of them last night shows that he trusts that shot. It's going to be a part of his arsenal, even if it didn't go in. But I was so impressed with the playmaking. 8 assists, 0 turnovers. They used him at the top of the key in all their delay series action where they throw in the ball in the trail spot, and he can pick teams apart as a passer. He's very patient. He doesn't force things, which goes to the 0 turnovers. But one strategy that New Orleans tried to do was to blitz Shai Gilgeous-Alexander in ball screens. Say, we can't guard him one-on-one. We're not going to have the opportunity to keep him out of the lane. The best thing to do when someone sets a ball screen for him is to blitz him and force it out of his hands. And Jalen Williams, being an awesome short roll playmaker and passer, is the perfect complement on the offensive end 100%. To a guy like Shai Gilgeous-Alexander to threaten that type of coverage. So if they end up going against a team like Minnesota or Denver, you know, in this next play-in game or in the first round, a team that wants to play more drop coverage, Jalen Williams being the creator in delay action, being a pick-and-pop shooter, those are going to be those areas that he can thwart it. But if they decide in crunch time to blitz Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and try to make somebody else beat them, Jalen Williams has already proven he's a fantastic processor, can make the right decision 4-on-3 almost every time. He is the perfect complement at that big man position to SGA. I'm disappointed I didn't have him higher on my board last year because of just how impactful he's been at both ends. But man, is he a great fit for this team.
great fit, great evaluation for what they needed him to be, I think, in Oklahoma City. Let's just talk about the Pelicans very briefly. They just had a Zion, sized hole in their lineup. And I will say, I thought it was interesting that CJ McCollum went on a bit of an extended discussion last night that we need guys to essentially be in the lineup and do the right things. That was, I thought, pretty pointed. Without saying Zion's name, I know that Larry Nance Jr. came out today with a tweet saying that we all back Zion in that locker room. We all love him. I'm sure that that's right. But I thought that CJ's frustration with the situation came out in the post-game presser. And it's disappointing that Zion didn't play. But, I think at the end of the day, we need Zion healthy. And Zion needs to make that commitment to be healthy. I do think that it is on him to be willing to continue to be in the utmost best physical condition he can be. And I thought that Rudy Gay said something earlier today on a podcast that I thought was interesting. It's hard to be overweight and have longevity in the NBA. It just genuinely is. Zion needs, we are losing a genuinely special talent, in my opinion. With Zion, the less that we see him play. And it's just an incredible bummer to me. I get why, if there are Pelicans fans and apparently people on the team a bit disappointed, I get it. What I will say about this, the thing that I thought turned it was obviously the third quarter that the Thunder won by 15. For whatever reason, Jonas Valanciunas went invisible in that third quarter. And I thought Jonas was actually kind of the key and the barometer for the Thunder, or for it really for the Thunder and the Pelicans in this game for stretches. I mean, he had 16 points, 18 rebounds. His physicality and strength really was kind of the mismatch that they could have taken advantage of with Jalen Williams. But in that third quarter, he didn't attempt a shot. And if you look through the rest of the game, the Pelicans win the second quarter by 9. They win the fourth quarter by 4. The first quarter was a tight first quarter that went to the Thunder by 3. The Thunder won that game in the third quarter, and I thought it was Jonas's absence was conspicuous in that third quarter, and it was a bit disappointing to see that.
I think this year, whether it's with Zion, without Zion, the Pelicans never fully gelled and came to fruition with getting the most out of each guy at the time that they needed him. We saw so many special games from Brandon Ingram down the stretch run of the season, but it just never fully clicked. And look, they're one rim pressure guy away from being a really good and dangerous team. We know who that is and will be on this roster long term. We need him healthy. We need to see him in the lineup, and his absence and the lack of other guys who could create easier shots instead of Brandon Ingram having to just make the right play and really tough plays time and time and time again, that's ultimately what ended up hurting the Pelicans, in my view.
Yeah, and they have a long offseason ahead. They're going to have to figure out answers in terms of that backcourt, in my opinion. And they have to figure out answers with Zion and see where that's going to go. Ultimately, the Thunder will play the Minnesota Timberwolves. The Lakers and Timberwolves set basketball back by like 5 years with that game. it was not an enjoyable contest to watch. Let's just be real about that. I thought Minnesota gave it away completely. This is a team that was leading throughout a majority of this contest, and ultimately what gave it away, I thought, was, yeah, you can point to Karl Towns having a really good offensive game and the fact that the team played really well when he was on the court, just in terms of their spacing and the way that the Lakers had to guard him. I thought it was very conspicuous in a good sense when Carl was on the court that it was just harder to double. It was harder to blitz Anthony Edwards. It was harder to do things when Towns was on the court. He took himself off the court with just like incredibly silly decisions.
Yeah.
That fifth foul where he just like grabbed Anthony Davis and just like pulled him down, It made no sense to me. Like, you have to have real game awareness there. And I thought that they were starting, it felt like to me, to really slow that run down for the Lakers in the fourth quarter when he got back on the court. And he took himself off the court in a really important moment. And that, I think, was ultimately the thing that really kind of cost them the game in a number of ways. He was their best player. Don't get me wrong. Like, he and him and Mike Conley were the two best players on the court, but it's not an accident that they were plus 18 in the minutes with Karl Towns. And, Karl unfortunately took himself off the court in critical minutes, and they lost the, what did they play? 53 minutes in this game. Yeah. They lost the 12 minutes that Karl Towns was off the court by, I think it was 24 points. And it was in large part because of choices that Towns made to take himself off the court, why he didn't play 47, 48 minutes in this game. That was not quite a must win, but a very real important moment for them.
Yeah. Shout out to Chris Finch for the way that he managed the rest of their minutes in their roster, because he did everything in his power as a coach to give them a fighting chance. And this is a lot of issues compounding for Minnesota right now, where the absence of Gobert in that game, not having a healthy McDaniels, there's no option to go to at that bigger spot that you can really trust. No Naz Reid. Not having those guys makes it really hard to sustain any minutes when Towns both isn't on the floor or isn't going supernova on the offensive end, because he had, I think, a stretch, or if I believe it was in the third quarter, when he just had a couple buckets in a row where he got really cooking.
Yeah.
And without having him there, Minnesota just didn't have enough size, physicality to be able to do anything against the Lakers. And look, we can talk so much about the missed opportunities, the lack of gel that the Timberwolves have really gone through throughout the season. They still got another chance at this thing. So, I want to see if they can grow into a little bit more with this final play-in game, and then maybe get to a positive result in a series against Denver. But I agree with you. It very much felt like this game was given away by just some poor choices that they were made, a lack of depth overall, and then having Anthony Edwards clearly not be at 100%.
Yeah, I mean, hot take, having two players that are your two best defenders out because of terrible decisions, Rudy Gobert choosing to punch Kyle Anderson in a huddle, and then Jaden McDaniels choosing to punch a wall in like the hallway and fracturing, what was it, his hand or his wrist? I can't remember which one. Just bad decision making across the board is what cost them this game. Those two and Towns. Like, I think they lost this game because of bad decision making.
And they had another opportunity. I think they were down three with 13 seconds to go. They got a steal on that inbound play where LeBron just threw it away a little bit. And instead of getting a layup out of the 3-on-1, like, I'm the first guy to criticize college announcers for talking about getting the quick two when you're down late, but you've got a 3-on-1 in transition with 15 seconds to go. And they end up taking a Torian Prince corner three, ends up missing, and now they're playing the foul game again. Like, they had their opportunities. They could have easily held on to the game. They could have easily put it away at the end. Didn't come to fruition.
Yeah, what I'll say as well about the Timberwolves, I saw a lot of consternation in regard to Anthony Edwards in this game. I thought the Lakers had a really good defensive strategy for Anthony Edwards. They just blitzed him constantly and made him get rid of the ball and made him make high level decisions to try and get those marginal advantages that come with two on the ball. And Anthony Edwards is not great at that yet. That's what I would do if I was Oklahoma City. I would be blitzing the ball every time Anthony Edwards has it and forcing the ball out of his hands and making guys like Karl Towns and Rudy Gobert, who should be back, beat me. And force that to be the strategy at the end of the day. I thought Darvin Ham, as much as I've criticized him this year, he had a very solid defensive strategy to make life harder for the Timberwolves in this game. I do question. I think that it was like a genuine strategy for them to kind of close out short on some of Minnesota's shooters. And early in the first half, I thought it really bit them. You saw Kyle Anderson end up making a couple of threes in that first half. You saw, I believe it was Torian Prince also make a couple of threes in that first half that, honestly, I thought, like, I don't want to say LeBron was at fault, but like, LeBron closing out short was what happened there. I just want to know more about what the strategy was. Like, I can see a world where Darvin Ham told them, hey, we're going to close out short as opposed to, and try and get a late contest as opposed to like really getting after these guys and forcing them to put the ball on the court and getting the team in scrambles in rotations. I thought that was really intriguing the way that the Lakers played the Timberwolves in this game. And the other piece of this too, Anthony Davis, you know, for as poorly as he seemed to start this game in the first half, he really came on in the second half, I thought. He kind of, and along with LeBron, obviously, those two just decided we are the best players on the court and we're going to the playoffs. And it can be that simple sometimes. It can be that transparent that LeBron James and Anthony Davis can take games over in ways that other guys can't.
Experienced veterans with the physical capabilities that they have are like sharks, man. As soon as they smell blood in the water, they know exactly what to do, how to turn that gear on, and they go into predator mode. And that's exactly what happened.
Yep. No. And for instance, like Dre here, you know, in the YouTube comments is saying Anthony Edwards fell in love with the three, should have attacked the rim more. Honestly, I thought it was the way that the Lakers played him defensively. I don't think that that was really an option. Like them blitzing those screens and really trying to like force the ball out of his hands. What that does is it makes him a perimeter player in a lot of ways. And what they could have done, I thought, was move him off the ball a little bit more, you know, have like a 1-5 pick and roll attack a little bit more often with Mike Conley, and then try and get Anthony Edwards the ball on a reversal, and then have Ant try and drive that way a little bit more. But that, you know, then you're taking the ball out of Anthony Edwards' hands. And I don't know if you want to do that all the time either. So it was, I thought the Lakers did very, very well to make life very, very difficult on Anthony Edwards, a young player who succeeded at an exceedingly high level last postseason, but it succeeded against a strategy defensively that did not necessarily, you know, force the ball out of his hands and make him make high level passing reads. And I think that's where the next step will come for Ant. And it'll come. Like, I think it will come by the time he's 24, 25 years old. He's just still so young. He's 21, 22, and you know, this is his third season in the NBA. It's going to take time for him, and that's okay. But, yeah, I thought the Lakers did an incredible job defensively in this game. Jared Vanderbilt also deserves a shout-out. Yeah. It's a lot easier to blitz ball screens when you have just, like, the Energizer Bunny just flying around and scrambling all over the place, both in those blitzing scenarios and on the weak side whenever it's not him involved in the primary action.
Yeah, Lakers-Grizzlies is going to be a fun series.
I'm so excited for that series. The last guy I do want to shout out here, I thought Rui Hachimura gave them real minutes, and I've been as questionable about Rui playing in the playoffs as anybody else. I thought he gave them really, really solid minutes in a way that helped them. Like, he made a couple of threes. I thought his size on the court was a real help for the Lakers at times. You look at the plus-minus metric, doesn't always tell the full story, but he was a plus 20 in that part of the game that he was on the court. And those minutes corresponded with a lot of non-Towns minutes. So I do think that's more why that happened in terms of the plus minus. But him just being a big body that was willing to shoot, willing to take creative shots, I thought was really, really important for the Lakers. Okay.
Lakers are dangerous, man. We've been saying it. They're dangerous.
We've been saying it for a while. I think they're genuinely dangerous. And frankly, I would pick them to beat the Grizzlies at this point. I would, going in. Yeah. Okay, let's go to the East. Do you want to start with Bulls, Raptors, or Hawks, Heat?
You know, I feel like we probably should start with Bulls, Raptors, and make this a swan song for Toronto, kind of the last time that that we talk about them here.
Let's do it. Okay, this is the DeMar DeRozan game. DeMar DeRozan is DeMar DeRozan's daughter, who was screeching at the top of her lungs every time the Raptors shot free throws. And it worked. The Raptors missed 18 free throws in a game that they lost by four. The Raptors, frankly, outplayed the Bulls in this game.
Yep.
They should have won this game. They outplayed them. They played better than the Chicago Bulls.
So,
and they absolutely pissed this game down the drain.
They did, but I also think that part of the reason they played so much better than the Bulls for the first 2.5 to 3 quarters was because of some ineptitude of Chicago's defensive game planning. And the way that they were kind of showing in ball screens or letting Jakob Poeltl pick them apart in the short roll really allowed Toronto to get a ton of easy looks at the basket. You look at the final quarter to quarter and a half, Chicago started switching. And when you have Nikola Vucevic, that does not sound like an appetizing strategy to come back and win a game. But it worked. And it showed, I think, some of the flaws that this Toronto Raptors offense has. Is they don't have a lot of guys who are really quick off the bounce. They have some big toolsy ball handlers, but they don't have guys who are quick enough to just go around somebody and get into the lane. And Fred VanVleet not being able to separate from Vucevic stalled out their offense. He had a three or maybe two over the top of Vooch, but man, did it look like they were, you know, a 1998 Game Boy in Pokemon just stuck with that question mark flashing over their heads. Like, well, we don't really know what to do.
That's ultimately been the story of the Raptors season, I think. Like, you can point to the defense, which was leaky throughout the first half of the season. But to me, it was that they never found half-court offensive answers with this roster. And ultimately, I mean, maybe we just like shift to what the Raptors do now. I mean, I'm really interested in Fred VanVleet's offseason, Gary Trent's offseason. What do they do to rebuild this roster? I mean, Jakob Poeltl is a free agent. Like, there are a lot of decisions to be made here. If I was the Raptors, I would be looking to try and find a way to shake this thing up in some manner and try and rebuild around Scottie Barnes and Pascal Siakam in an intriguing way. I mean, like, I'm sure they want to keep Poeltl given the asset that they gave up for him, but it felt like all of those guys really kind of operate in similar spaces. Jakob is great in that short roll area. You know, Pascal loves those like mid-post, you know, mid-range areas. You know, Scottie Barnes, you know, just isn't impactful from beyond the three-point line right now as a scorer. So how do they get around that kind of, you know, mess in the mid-range area right now where everything kind of seems so clumped together when they play? And I do think there are ways around it. I think that, you know, Jakob gave them a lot in terms of some gravity, in terms of some ability to, you know, take pressure off of guys that, like a Fred VanVleet, when he got blitzed in ball screen actions, which was happening quite often. It's just, I don't know, man. Like, I just don't buy this roster build. Like, we've talked about it throughout the year on this show. I just think that they need some sort of shakeup in a real way.
It would help if they had tenable depth. And I think that this is a team that they went six deep really throughout the stretch run of the season here after the Poeltl trade. And there's no great young player that you could see as an asset that you would want to flip outside of Scottie Barnes. And he's the guy that you're trying to build around. So there
they do have one. Like, let's be clear. Like, OG Anunoby is still like an elite asset league wide. Like, there are a number of teams that will pay a substantial premium to acquire OG Anunoby. But again, like, OG to me is the kind of guy that you exactly want next to Scottie Barnes and Pascal Siakam as a 3-and-D player that will space the floor and defend high level like players to take the pressure off of those guys defensively and let them grow into their offensive roles even more. I just don't like this roster build, just straight up. That's we talk about, like, I've talked about this a lot on the show. Oklahoma City and Toronto are doing very similar things. They are valuing positional size, positional length, strength, skill with the ball for your size and for your position, the ability to play like inside out. What they're not valuing in Toronto's case is that ability to be like glue, to have that high level processing speed, to have that shooting and skill basis to their game. It's almost like they think they can teach those guys how to do it once they get into their scheme. Oklahoma City is drafting guys that have that already. Think Jalen Williams, 6'6", 7'2" wingspan. Chet Holmgren, 7', 7'6" wingspan. Think Shea Gilgeous-Alexander, Josh Giddey. All of these guys we talk about with Oklahoma City, plus positional size, plus positional length, plus positional skill level, processing speed, all of it. It's just the flip side of the coin of what Toronto is doing, and it's the right call whenever you're calling heads or tails. So I do not like the way Toronto has built this roster at all, and I think that there is there's going to have to be a reckoning at some point with all of this.
And I don't think that it's necessarily blow it all up time, but I think it's also you have to make some changes to add more IQ, more quickness, and more three-point shooting to this roster. Yeah. And you don't have a lot of younger guys, younger assets, guys on rookie contracts that are really attractive around the league that you can flip or include as part of those deals. So Masai Ujiri has to be really creative with how he retools this on the fly. A lot of questions for Toronto, but I also want to give Chicago some credit for kind of ending their season and the way that they played, the adjustments that they made defensively down the stretch. They have been really small since the All-Star break, but they're making it work because they're just a team filled with really tough dudes.
Yep. Okay. Let's go to this final game, and it was the first game that was played within the play-in tournament. The Hawks and Miami Heat. The Hawks go on the road and beat the Miami Heat. Fascinating game for a number of reasons. I thought Trae Young did a really good job of dealing with the defensive pressure that Miami put upon him. But ultimately, I thought this game was won by Clint Capella. Clint Capella scored 4 points in this game, and he was the best player on the court. Genuinely, he was absolutely incredible. His offensive rebounding, his just overall defensive ability in space, his defensive ability to swallow up Bam Adebayo, I thought was really, really important, given how important Bam has been to Miami's offensive structure and identity this season, taking up that bigger role. I thought Clint was the best player on the court in this game, and I thought he was absolutely enormous, and he is why the Atlanta Hawks are going to the playoffs.
If you want to know the value of three-point shooting and one really good perimeter player star, watch this game, because Miami had to come out and defend them more aggressively and on the perimeter. They had to. And that opened up short roll or, you know, immediate quick rip opportunities for everybody else on the roster. The Hawks did get some wide open catch shoot threes in this game, but it opened up the offensive glass. And when you have a small roster the way that Miami does, and you send your biggest guy out to try to defend the perimeter and Trae Young, as soon as that first line of defense is broken, you've got no rim protection behind. You've got no ability to secure a defensive rebound and end that position if you are able to force a miss. And Atlanta just relentlessly went after that. They spaced the floor, put the ball in Trae Young's hands, and said, great, whatever happens as soon as the ball enters the three-point line, we're going to go get it. If it's a miss, we're going to slam it down or hit a wide open three otherwise. And it just, it worked. It was simple basketball and it worked.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. With Miami particularly, it was really interesting. I thought Tyler Hero really struggled in the first half of this game. I thought that it was really interesting the way Atlanta like lined up defensively. Typically, like you would think you would use DeAndre Hunter as like your stopper, right? Like you'd throw DeAndre onto like a Tyler Hero or a Jimmy Butler, and felt like they didn't really do that, which was intriguing to me. Like I felt like they would like utilize him more in that way, given that he's not like always an impactful help defender, but they didn't. And they just kind of rolled like DeJounte Murray onto critical guys. Like it was really, really intriguing to watch the way that Quinn Snyder just kind of rolled through these matchups. And Spo eventually adjusted. He got Kyle Lowry out there, had him kind of running off of screens and making him like the release valve, it felt like at times. Kyle had 33 points and really turned back the clock in this game. And now the Miami Heat gets to go on and play the Chicago Bulls to try and make the playoffs. And look, I think the Heat are the favorites in this game, like undeniably, but it's a fascinating, fascinating game, I think.
Yeah, the thing that beat them against Atlanta, the offensive glass, is not something that Chicago will overwhelm you with based on size. But if you size up a guy like Patrick Beverley, who just finds a way to make an impact, even though he's a little bit scared to shoot the ball out there, then you find yourself in a position where you can be shortchanged or where you you're not going to get the result that you want. So less of a contrast of styles, But I think the Atlanta-Miami game, really well coached on both ends. We're just seeing that Eric Spoelstra does not have the defensive versatility to weaponize this roster in a variety of ways, where he's kind of got to live with who they are and just maximize Bam Adebayo and hope that the rest of it falls into place.
Well, he doesn't have enough dudes. Like, let's just be real about it. Like,
doesn't have enough dudes.
Like, I love Max Strus, and I love the story of Gabe Vincent. And, you know, I think Caleb Martin's been a really fun story this year, but like, these guys are not guys that should be playing. What did they play? I think it was like 75 minutes in this game between the three of them. That's like almost two positions on the court at all times that are being kind of taken up by guys that frankly probably aren't good enough to be in those games in very high leverage roles, like fifth man in like a critical moment in the playoffs. So I think the Heat just need to go out and find dudes. Like, it's kind of simple. Like, I like Jimmy, I like Bam. You know, they're going to figure out an answer for Kyle Lowry, who had a very underwhelming season, but they still have a chance to make playoffs, certainly, and I'd be intrigued to see them play the Milwaukee Bucks, given the trouble they've given the Bucks previously, but I don't know if they're going to be able to give them a ton of trouble this year with just how the offense seems to be playing. Okay, let's take a break, and then we're going to talk about the Dallas Mavericks. All right, Adam. The Dallas Mavericks basically decided to sit everybody on their roster for the final two games.
Yeah.
They were in a play-in race, like genuinely. Like, they could have made the play-in at the time that they decided to do this. The NBA is investigating this. They are looking into the decision to essentially toss these two games and try and keep their draft pick. That's ultimately the key thing. They have a top 10 protected pick that goes to New York if the Mavericks fall outside of the top 10 in this NBA draft. And by losing those two games, they're currently slotted in at 10. If one of New Orleans, Toronto, Orlando, Oklahoma City jumps into the top four, they will lose that pick. Currently, I believe that the chances of that happening are, you know, I can try and do math on this. I think that it's like not wildly high, given the fact that Dallas also would have an opportunity. I think they have something like, what is it? I think they have like a 14% chance or so to jump into the top four themselves. And then they have something like, I don't know. I think it's
around 20.
To drop out. Yeah. So it's going to be really interesting to see what happens there. What was your reaction to Dallas deciding to sit there, guys?
To me, it feels like the law of unintended consequences from a league standpoint, that if you allow teams to top 10 protect their picks and make a lot of these deals, you're putting them in a position where they've got to weigh the long game versus the short game. And if you are an objective person and you've watched the Dallas Mavericks play basketball over the last, 2 months now, you pretty much know that they don't have much of a chance of winning a postseason series with how cooked their defense has been.
Yep.
And this is, in my view, the right long-term call for the Dallas Mavericks to take, because they can get some immediate value out of this in a pivotal summer for them, whether they keep the pick or they end up trading it for something that would help them a little bit more immediately as a veteran. Not saying I recommend that, but saying that that option is at least on the table. And we know right now that, you know, the 2024 draft, when they might kick this pick down to, had it transfer, or if it transfers to the Knicks, is not going to be an incredibly strong one. Plus, they're probably going to be better next year and would have a lesser pick in the draft. So I see this as more so about the loophole in the NBA rules that is just the unfortunate reality of the situation. The league can and may want to investigate them and the decision-making that went into this as much as they want. It's a shame that Jason Kidd sat in a press conference and really said the quiet part out loud that we all know and we're all thinking. But if we're talking about long-term decision-making for an organization, This isn't the first time we've seen it, and I don't think it's the wrong call for them to make.
I think it was the right call. I don't like it.
Yeah.
I don't think it was within the spirit of basketball. Like, I don't think it was in the spirit of competition. And part of me is like, look, this defense is a mess, and we know that the rest of the lineups are a mess, and they never figured out front court rotations. And look, we'll talk a lot about Nico Harrison here in a minute and what this Mavs front office has done to this roster, and I think it's worth talking about. But like, part of me is like, you have Luka Doncic and Kyrie Irving, and you're going to be going to play like a Pelicans team that, you know, could or potentially could have been playing a Pelicans team that has also been a mess. You're going to play potentially a Timberwolves team that the end result was, you know, Rudy Gobert punching a teammate and Jaden McDaniels being out, taking off their best option for guarding Luka Doncic in a series. And if you have Luka and Kyrie, part of me is like, we saw this last year. We know what comes of this. Mavericks are an incredibly dangerous team in the playoffs because of Luka. They also have Kyrie. Kyrie is a dangerous playoff player. I do agree with you, though, that I think it's unlikely, given their defensive structure, they could have gotten stops in the playoffs. And ultimately, I do think that this Kyrie trade was seen and completed with the idea of them looking forward toward next year and the years beyond that. I think that they saw an opportunity to get a superstar player to pair next to Luka Doncic that they think will fit next to Luka. And as long as Kyrie stays on the court and does everything he's supposed to do, I am a believer in the Kyrie-Luka fit, because they are both high-level processors, decision-makers, shooters, skill players. We had questions about the Chris Paul, you know, James Harden fit until we didn't, right? And those guys are incredible shooters, processors, playmakers with the ball in their hand. I'm a believer in the Kyrie-Luka thing being a fit long-term. I am. The problem for me is, if I was a Dallas fan, and what would ultimately be concerning to me is, A, I don't know how much you can trust Kyrie. Like, let's just be straight up about this. And B, I just don't buy what Nico Harrison has done in terms of building this roster. I came on this show last year when they traded for Christian Wood, and I said I did not think that this was a good move. I said something along the lines of, look, whatever, it's a decent swing to take, but I don't think he's going to play in critical minutes in the playoffs, and I would have rather had the opportunity cost of having that 27th overall pick in hand and try to use it to get somebody else that I think would have been different. I said at the time that I thought Maxi Kleber was going to play over Christian Wood in important minutes. And look, at the end of the day, Jason Kidd never trusted Christian Wood, never trusted him defensively. And that's, in my opinion, Christian Wood was a great offensive player this year. He's probably like in a vacuum worth the 27th overall pick, but trades aren't made in a vacuum when teams have limited assets to spare. And ultimately, I think that Christian Wood was the wrong trade to make for this team, because I just didn't buy him defensively. Do I think that trading Dorian Finney-Smith and Spencer Dinwiddie was the wrong trade for Dallas? I would have done everything I could to keep Dorian Finney-Smith, but I kind of do think that that was fine. Genuinely, like, I understood why you would do that, thinking that you can get a Dorian Finney-Smith more easily than you can get a Kyrie Irving. And I think that that is a reasonable stance to take along with the first round pick. The problem is that you look at Nico Harrison's other moves. It's JaVale McGee to a 3-year deal. The moves you don't make to try and fill in the gaps defensively at the deadline to surround Kyrie and Luka Doncic with guys that can play. Try to find a big. Those guys were not like wildly expensive on the market this trade deadline. Like, you look at what Mason Plumlee went for. You look at what other guys that were bigs on the market went for. They were available. I think that Nico Harrison is not the right guy to run this show. And look, we should throw around blame to Mark Cuban a little bit. We know that Mark Cuban is involved in the front office, right? Like, we need to be real about that. Mark Cuban is involved in their front office. Here's the thing. Mark Cuban's not going away. Like, Mark Cuban is a stagnant for Dallas. He owns the team. So I really do think that they need to strongly consider kind of looking to revamp the front office, looking to revamp the coaching staff. I was not impressed with Jason Kidd this year. I didn't think that he did much of anything creative. I didn't think that the defensive identity that he had last season that led to their run carried over to year two. And you can look at the roster and say that they made poor moves to do that. I wouldn't disagree necessarily, but I also think that, you know, it might not have been Jason Kidd that was the defensive identity. I think it might have been those dudes in the locker room that were the defensive identity. So if I was a Mavericks fan right now, I wouldn't be pissed about the tanking. I wouldn't be upset that the team decided we can't make a run this year. I'd just be pissed about Nico Harrison and Jason Kidd being the guys making the decisions and making critical roles within this, or critical decisions within this ecosystem at this point.
The one thing that doesn't quite sit right with me right now, and I'm a big Mark Cuban guy. I always have been. I love the passion that he puts into owning a team. I wish we had more owners in sports that were like him in that regard. I don't think that it makes me uncomfortable to watch them pull themselves out of the playoff race to try to make this long-term decision for the pick while simultaneously trying to criticize all of the behind-the-scenes factors that took Jalen Brunson away from Dallas.
And you know what? Like, I have to be careful with what I say here. I think that Mark Cuban is correct in terms of what he said.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how much of a chance Dallas had to retain Jalen Brunson. I would have paid more than the Knicks to retain him. I went on the show at the time when everyone said that was an overpay, and I said I thought it wasn't. So I've been in on the Jalen Brunson deal the Knicks signed from the jump. I think that, you know, Dallas should have just been like, left him a voicemail being like, look, we'll pay you $4,120 to stay. You know what I mean? Like, look, do whatever you have to get that decision across, but like, 100%. Or to get that information across. But like, I am not surprised.
What
ended the way it did with the Knicks.
What Cuban said was right. But the timing and the lack of awareness to complain about being cheated out of something while you're kind of skirting around the rules to keep that 10th overall pick or the chance at that 10th pick just doesn't sit right with me. That's all.
Yep. Yeah. And look, like the real like error with Dallas, right? The original sin with Dallas, with Jalen Brunson, was they should have just signed him to the 455 extension.
The extension, yeah.
Like Jalen Brunson had already proven himself to be like the perfect foil for Luka Doncic even before the playoff breakout last year. Like, I thought they should have signed it to him the offseason before. You know what I like? I thought that Jalen had proven enough to be worth that deal, especially knowing what the TV money is going to look like down the road and with the way the salary cap is going to continue to rise. Like that was a deal that made a lot of sense to me to sign him to 455, even at the time. That is where they originally should have been able to retain Jalen Brunson, in my opinion. And that was the error that was made with Jalen Brunson. I don't think it was in free agency from Dallas's perspective. I think it was prior, not offering that extension, because Jalen was awesome his third season in Dallas. We had enough information on Jalen at that point to know that he was worth that money.
He'd been awesome for a long time. I love Jalen Brunson. I love him.
Yeah. No, I think he's absolutely terrific. Now, here comes the rest of this. Now, if you're Dallas, what do you do moving forward here? Give me 1 second. I'll close the loop on tanking. Like, do I think the league should do something to curtail tanking in some way? I mean, look, find Dallas, whatever, do what you have to do. You know, I don't know if you could find Dallas enough based on the current rules in the collective bargaining agreement to where, you know, it's worth it for Mark Cuban not to do this. But I don't think you can really do anything to stop this. And the reason is that basketball is such an individually driven, star-laden sport that the more bites at the apple you have to find that star, find that second star, find that third star that's necessary to win a title, I think that you have to continue taking them. And ultimately, I don't really see any way that tanking will be curtailed. I don't think there's any way the league can really do it, unfortunately, because realistically, like, okay, take draft picks away, I guess. Like, that could be the argument. Like, try and take this draft pick away. That feels egregious to me for, like, a two-game tank, right? Yeah. Look at what Portland's done the last 2 years. Yeah. Like, Portland has sat Damian Lillard in the middle of Damian Lillard's best season of his career. What are we going to do? Are we going to strip Portland of their pick? Are we going to strip X, Y, and Z teams of their pick? I'm not in favor of that. I think that's aggressive and, you know, overly sensitive to what this issue is. So yeah, no, I would just continue down the road of, if teams want to do this, fine, find them, do whatever you have to do. But I also don't think there is a world where we should make lottery odds even flatter than what we have. Like, they're flat enough as it is. You have a 14% chance to win the lottery if you are the worst team in the league. You have, you know, like a 12% chance if you are the fourth worst team. You have a 10% chance if you're the fifth worst team. You can fall. You have a 50-50 shot basically to fall all the way out of the top four if you are the worst team in the NBA. So I think the way they flatten lottery odds are fine. Yep. I just think the league is such a star-driven league that when you don't have it, your best chance is to try and go to the draft. And at the end of the day, I'm just not like an abolish the draft person. Like, I'm sorry. Like, I get the argument for it, but I think in a league where you want to have some degree of parity, you don't want it to become European football, which is basically, I think, what it would become at the end of the day.
Yep. Totally agree.
Okay, where do you think Dallas goes this offseason now?
Oh, I don't have a damn clue. I have no idea what I would do if I were in charge of that organization, because so much of it is tied up in decisions related to the cap, right? And I think the first domino with that is probably Christian Wood. You've got to have a really smart game plan and know what your long-term decision is going to be with re-signing him, with how long do you keep him around, what infrastructure can you try to cobble together to make a Kyrie, Luka, Christian Wood team work, and can you afford that infrastructure here this offseason and this summer? Because I think this is the 1 year where Dallas pretty much has no margin for error. We hear some rumblings about Luka. I don't want to speak those into existence or verify any of that. No idea. But they need to do a really good job immediately in this year to make the right decisions and make this a playoff viable roster next season. Hopefully the pick helps them with that. Whether they keep it, whether they trade it, depends on how they, if they're around a 10, who's on the board, can they jump up into the top four, completely changes the complexion of what the offseason might look like for them. But at the end of the day, they've got to do something, and they've got to add a lot of versatile 3-and-D type of pieces around the core that they have.
Yeah, and I think they need an answer on the interior as well. I think this is probably a team that you have to play drop coverage with, and I think you have to find that interior presence as a center that can give you that opportunity. The problem is that, like, Jakob Poeltl is probably the guy, like, in free agency that makes sense. It's just that, like, they don't really have a mechanism unless that they try and trade, like, the 10th overall pick if they get that pick for Jakob Poeltl and, like, a sign-and-trade involving Dwight Powell or some shit. Like, I don't know. I'm, like, just trying to throw shit at the wall on some level. But, you know, it might not be, might be, like, JaVale and something else, right? Because you can get to the money in some manner. But yeah, like I think that that's what you have to do. You have to try and find an interior presence. You have to find 3-and-D wings that can make sense for you. And you have to kind of go from there. Like you have to have more of an interior defensive presence, I think, in addition to having more mobility on the wings defensively. I think that's the critical piece for Dallas this offseason. They have enough offense. You can makeshift find offense with the dudes you have in the backcourt. You just got to find some front court play. You've got to find those guys that can defend on the wings.
And okay. luckily for them, Sam, those tend to be a little bit cheaper.
They do. That they do. Okay. The funnier answer is something that Thomas Carniero just put into the YouTube comments. Yeah. I'm not going to put it on the screen because like it doesn't even really work functionally just because of some of the free agency pieces involved. But a Rudy Gobert trade, if Minnesota decides to end that experiment after 1 year, is actually really interesting for them. Wow. It's actually like it solves a lot of their problems, if we're being completely honest.
Oh boy.
That's something I would look into. But again, like if you're Minnesota, what does Dallas have that you'd want to do? Cause like, I don't think that you do Kyrie for Gobert if you're Dallas necessarily.
Yeah. So. And you can't tell me we're going to have Gobert and Kyrie in the same locker room, right? Like I'm watching every game the Mavs play next year, if that's the case.
Let's just go crazy. Okay, let's go to some guys that have decided not to be in the 2024 or 2023 NBA draft, and instead we'll try their luck in the 2023 draft. So ostensibly, the Monday show tends to be a draft podcast. This is a Thursday show with Adam Spinella. We are going to be focusing more on the 2023 NBA draft, typically on the Monday show here. But, Adam, we had a number of players decide to try their luck in 2024. The reason for that is, I think it is important to say, A, some of these guys just might not have seen themselves as ready. I think Donovan Klingon would have been a top 20 pick at the end of the day, if I'm being completely honest. And he decided to go back to Connecticut. We'll talk about him momentarily. But the 2024 NBA draft, it really cannot be emphasized enough. It is a weaker class than what this class is, especially at the top. I am genuinely not sure that there is a player in the 2024 draft that would be taken in the top 5 or 6 in this class. And look, guys will emerge. Like Matis Puzelis is really intriguing, and I think he's awesome. There's a chance that like he blows the doors off the G League Ignite and makes it to the point where he is the kind of dude that would be in the class of being like a top 5 pick this year, for sure. There are other players I really like in this class. But at the end of the day, this is a very weak 2024 class. And I think that it is, for some players, worth trying their luck later because of how weak that class is forthcoming.
And there's a couple other factors that go into that too, Sam. First is NIL money, which is a game changer for a lot of guys to be able to stay in college a little bit longer, to feel like there aren't these financial pressures around any of the decisions to leave or turn pro. And then one other area that has started to pop up a little bit more, particularly with second round picks over the last year or two, is that now NBA teams have these two-way contracts as mechanisms to sign them to. And two-way deals offer less long-term and immediate financial stability as a standard second-round contract that you might sign with 2 years guaranteed and potential options beyond that. So if you don't end up going in the top 30, but you declare this year, you really change the long-term stability and trajectory that you might be on if you entered the class and just missed. That going back to college, making a little bit of money with the NIL that you have, and betting on not just yourself to get better in that environment, but comparatively showing better next to what we think is going to be a weaker class, could pay off. And I think we've seen quite a few talented guys who are maybe right on that first round bubble this year make the decision to go back to school.
I think that that's right. And I also think that there's an interesting thing happening for some of the older players in this class with the addition of the third two-way. speaking of the two-way contracts, where the fact that there might be some guys, for instance, like Jeremy Roach declared for the draft this year, right? Ostensibly, I'm not particularly a fan of Jeremy Roach as a potential NBA player. You know, had a really interesting season at Duke, had a great postseason in 2022. He's small. He's not like an elite level shooter. He's not an elite level decision maker. It feels like the injury that he suffered in high school may have like kind of sapped a little bit of burst from his game from when I saw him earlier in his career. So that guy could really potentially look at the third two-way contract and see it as an opportunity to where, you know what, I might be on the borderline of getting a second two-way. Now there are 30 additional spots for guys like me. I might be willing to do this. And Jeremy Roach is declaring while maintaining his eligibility. I think that there are a number of potential avenues he could take at Duke in the transfer portal, potentially pro options as well. But let's talk about some of the guys that decided to go back to school. And I think that the one that took most by surprise was probably Kyle Filipowski. Kyle Filipowski, for what it's worth, from what I know, this had been discussed as a real potential outcome basically since, like, for a while. Like, there was never any clarity that Kyle Filipowski was going to be in this draft. Other guys that have already declared, I've known for a while they were going to be in this class, right? It's just kind of the way that the world works. When I'm talking to agents all the time, I'm talking to insiders, I'm talking to sources on the team side, you kind of get a feel for who's going to be in this class and who's going to not be in this class. Kyle Filipowski was a very real question mark in terms of whether or not he was going to stay or go, basically even after he'd already broken out at Duke. And the answer I'd gotten was he really loves college. And there are real, let's be 100 about this, right? There are real opportunities for being like a very high profile, like white kid at Duke in terms of the NIL market, right? So he is always been someone that was on the borderline of staying or going. I think he likely would have been a first round pick had he decided to come out. I also think Kyle Filipowski's defense is kind of underrated. And I think that as teams would have gone down the road of evaluating and scouting him, you would have seen that you would have gotten more discussion about that. I thought that his mobility this year in space was a little bit better than what people thought. There's a lot more Kelly Olynyk to his game than there is, like, you know, stiff white dude you can't move to his game. And he is now going to lead the Duke Blue Devils next season, along with Tyrese Proctor. And for as much as Kyle Filipowski has gotten the headlines in regard to his 2023 NBA draft decision, I will have Tyrese Proctor higher on my board next year, entering the draft. I really truly thought that if Tyrese Proctor had tried his luck in this draft, I thought there was a pretty good shot he would have gone like 25th overall. I know that he started the season poorly. I know that the full season numbers do not look awesome in terms of efficiency. By the end of the season, his defensive play, some of the things he did in terms of in ball screen actions as a scorer had drastically improved.
Yes.
His playmaking out of ball screens has always been there. He is like a 6'4" to 6'5" lead guard who can defend, who wants to defend, who does have real skills with the ball in his hands. There are some growth opportunities for him, and we'll talk about that momentarily. But I think Tyrese Proctor is going to be a lottery pick in 2024. I do. I think that we're going to look at him as the guy that returned to college basketball that was the critical decision of all of them throughout this process.
I co-sign that. And I have been such a Proctor defender this entire season because Duke's offense was not set up to put him in a position where his pick and roll playmaking popped. What he needed to get better at was obviously his 3-point shooting and the reliability behind the arc. and having some way to score with the ball in his hands when he's attacking the basket. I think he found that at the end of the year. He has this crafty kind of mid-range game, this step back, this almost spin move into a jump shot that he gets to. Really, really smart, cerebral player on both ends of the floor, but super young. Would have been young for this draft class, to the point where going back to school next year, we're going to look at him and we're going to say, oh, that's a young sophomore who's gotten so much better already, has positional size, feel, plays well on both ends. What are we missing here? I mean, this is a guy who's tailor-made to shoot up those draft boards. I think that's a really good call.
Yeah, I truly think that Tyrese is going to be, you know, I don't know if he'll be an All-American next season. I think Kyle Filipowski certainly will be an All-American next season. I really do think that Tyrese is going to be the guy that we look at as leading Duke to that top five mark. He's like the X factor. Like, we know Filipowski is going to go for like 18 and 10 next year and just be absolutely tremendous, right? Tyrese is the guy that's going to take the biggest leap, in my opinion, in terms of what his game looks like, because we saw it in the second half of the season. We saw what it looks like. We saw what he is capable of. And oh, by the way, I do think Kyle Filipowski has a real chance to go in the lottery as well. I'll probably have him at like 14 entering next season. I'll have Tyrese at like 9 or 10, but I will have Filipowski at, you know, 14 or so. And I think Filipowski is going to have a tremendous season. The other big addition is that they get back Mark Mitchell.
Yes.
And Mark Mitchell is a guy that had a very strong defensive season for Duke. Ultimately, the question is about what his offensive fit is at the next level. He's not really a shooter right now. He can kind of handle the ball, but not really at the level he needs to yet for the NBA. There are some real skills there that I think will lead to him being a high-level player. And I think he will play in the NBA at some point. He's really tough, really physical, really aggressive. And as soon as that shot comes along, I think he is going to be really, really good. The thing about Duke next year, including Mark Mitchell, Kyle Filipowski, Tyrese Proctor, all three of those guys are tough, man. And they're also getting in Sean Stewart. I don't know how much you've seen of Sean Stewart, man. Like, that dude's physical as hell. Like, that dude plays like a tough brand of basketball, like in a way that is like fun to watch. They also get in Jared McCain, Caleb Foster, TJ Power, skilled freshmen that I think are high level. Guys like Jaden Shutt should be able to bring high level shooting to the team next season. They have the toughness, the physicality, they have the skill level. I do genuinely think Duke should be the number one team entering next season. I'm not sure it's all that close, given that they actually have some real older players that will be a part of their roster.
Yeah, this is going to be a power to watch out for in college basketball. And I really like Mark Mitchell long term. I think he was super raw this year and gave them as much as he could on the defensive end. But if we're talking long term with the skills and fluidity, this is my Coach Spin's hot take of the day. I much prefer him to a guy like Noah Clowney out of Alabama. I think that the defensive impact, the skill with the ball in his hands is a little bit more intriguing to me.
I think people are getting a little ahead of themselves with Noah Clowney. Just a little bit. Like, I'm intrigued. Like, 25 to 45 is where I'm at on Noah Clowney. I've seen him creep into, like, the teens in some places. Yeah. I like him as a 25 to 45 guy, for sure. Yeah. That's more where I'm seeing it right now. Any other thoughts on Duke before we move on?
No, I think that their roster is going to pop a little bit more because they're not trying to play six bigs at the same time, and they'll have real three-point shooting around Proctor, Filipowski, and Mitchell. I think it's much better designed next year, and I'm really looking forward to see the evolution of John Shire as a coach. I grew up a Duke fan, love what the Blue Devils have always kind of done to maximize who they are. And I think Shire got so much better as a coach throughout the season and figured out what buttons to press with his team. But hopefully this roster, with as much talent and a better fit on paper, so to speak, he won't have to wait as long to figure out what those buttons are.
Yeah. And honestly, I thought John was pretty good this year, to be honest.
He's great.
Like, I genuinely do. I thought that he had a good feel for when to make adjustments. And I thought that later in the season, he had a good feel for what buttons to press in terms of like defensive identity and things like that to get the most out of guys like Derek Lively. Okay. The next guy on our list that we want to talk about is Donovan Clingan. Donovan Clingan is another guy that I will have as a lottery pick next year. I wrote about Donovan Clingan's decision after he made the choice to go back to Connecticut. Just a few of the numbers on Donovan Clingan here that I wrote about, because they are absolutely fucking bonkers, and I want people to know them. I genuinely do not think Donovan Clingan would have gotten outside of the top 20 in this NBA draft. That is just straight up. I talked to someone that does some modeling in terms of like statistics for college players in the NBA draft space. Donovan Clingan was number one in their stats only model for the 2023 NBA draft. That is insane. That's just completely bonkers. Second, when Donovan Clingan was on the court, Connecticut's opponents, do you know what they shot at the basket, Spence?
Please tell me it's like 35%.
Yeah, this includes transition opportunities. They shot 41%.
Yeah, jeez.
When he was on the court per pivot analysis. When Donovan Clingan was on the court, teams only scored 89.9 points per 100 possessions versus 103 points per 100 possessions when he was off the court. 89.9 points per 100 possessions is a fucking insane number for college basketball. Like, I don't know that I've seen a number like that ridiculous for a player with that kind of differential that plays like real genuine minutes and like is the identifiable piece on why the defense improves when he's on the court. In terms of the production, like you're talking about a guy that, you know, averaged 7.6 rebounds, two blocks in 13 minutes per night. I talked to Clingan, you know, at the Final Four after their game against Miami. I just kind of straight up asked him. I was like, look, I've kind of stood next to guys that are like 7'1", 7'2" before. I'm like, not totally sure you're 7'2". Like, are you a little bit taller than that? And he was like, I think I'm a little bit taller than 7'2" at this point. Yeah. And I think he is. I think he's going to measure closer to 7'3". I don't know what he'll be listed at next year. We'll find out, obviously, but Donovan at least told me he thinks he's though in the maybe 7'2", 7'5" range, something like that. So a little bit bigger. He's a true, let's at least say this, he's a true 7'2" guy. Like, he's huge. Not, yeah, like he's not like, oh, he's listed at 7'2", he's something else. He's not that. He's big. He's enormous, if we're being clear about it. And he's big. His frame is enormous. Like, Brook Lopez, like, part of why he's been so successful this season is he has that frame, right? It's not just the, you know, the length and the size and the rim protection. It's the fact that he's big. He just takes up space. Yeah. He takes up enormous amounts of space in the lane and just makes it more crowded and harder to maneuver around. Clingan has that attribute as well. He can move. Like, yeah. Donovan's short area quickness is better than what I thought it was. Like, seeing him up close to the Final Four, it's something, man. Like, he's not a stiff. Like, there are some, like, occasional uncoordinated moments where, like, he gets the ball and just kind of flings one, you know? But he's not – that's going to get out of his game real quick. That's going to go real fast out of his game. And the coordination is real. He's, like, one of the more well-proportioned seven-footers I've seen before. Like, sometimes you can have super high hips. Sometimes you can have, like, really – thin shoulders, kind of. For like an NBA frame, he is as well proportioned a seven footer as I've seen. This is a lottery pick, in my opinion, just straight up. Like, next year in 2024, that's a lottery pick.
He's got real touch around the basket, soft hands. Obviously the defensive upside is massive, pun intended, with his frame. The thing to me about kind of Clingan and just thinking about his long-term fit in the NBA is exactly what you mentioned with how he can move his feet for one or two steps and just eat up space. I've watched him play earlier in high school and all the way through to where he's at now at UConn. He's so physically imposing on the court, even against other great athletes, even against other really good players. You know, we watch a lot of tape for what we do, Sam. And I think there are only two guys who genuinely make me laugh every time I watch them play, just because what I'm watching is stupid. Yeah. Victor Wembanyama is obviously one, but Donovan Clingan is the other. Like in the final four, he's tipped to himself one-handed offensive rebounds. You just can't help yourself but laugh. You're like, what the hell is anyone supposed to do against this guy? And to be
Miami, right?
Yeah. Well, and to be able to combine that just physical, I'm in awe of his physicality with some real skill, real touch, the ability to move his feet for one or two steps and be coordinated. He's got a real, real, real shot at this.
Yep. Okay. Next on our list is Riley Kugel. Riley Kugel is a 6'5" scoring guard out of Florida. I thought Kugel had a great close to the season after Colin Castleton got hurt. And Florida needed somebody that could really step into the lineup and just go get buckets, frankly. I think Kugel had a really, really phenomenal kind of final 10 games. You look at those last 10 games, he averaged 17 points, 4 rebounds, shot 49.6% from the field, 39.6% from three with a plus true shooting percentage overall. He has a long way to go. He's a long way to go in terms of the defense, in terms of the decision making. But like I talked to Florida staff, I think after the third game, I watched Kugel back in November, and I said, guys, this is an NBA player. Like he moves like an NBA player. It's probably not this year, but I think that by 2024, he's probably an NBA player. And it came even faster than what I thought. Like I think he probably would have gone in the top 40 this year had he decided to come out. But he decides to go back. Florida's roster is in a really positive position now. They've done a really great job in the transfer portal already, getting Walter Clayton, the MAAC Player of the Year, as well as Micah Handlockton, who was the Sun Belt Rookie of the Year due to his defensive upside, a very similar player to Colin Castleton, that will allow them to play a stylistically similar way to how they want to play. Plus, they have Will Richard and his floor spacing ability as well next season. It's a really strong fit for Riley Kugel on that team. And the Gators will go, I think, as far as he takes them, in my opinion. If he morphs into that guy that can be a 20-point-per-game scorer consistently with the talent around him, I think the Gators have a real shot to be like a top 4 or 5 seed in the NCAA tournament next year.
I have no notes. I have nothing to add there because you took my opportunity to talk about how well they've done in the portal. Like they've been great.
Yeah.
The one thing I would say is scorers like Kugel, who are really good at filling it up, those are the guys that can really make a large ascent. That if he's averaging 18 to 24 on efficient splits next year and Florida is winning games, that's the one guy who I think could leapfrog this into the top 10 and a little bit higher, just because those are the guys that you draft for earlier. It's similar to the type of ascent that we saw from a guy like Jaden Ivey a couple of years ago with his sophomore breakout. Different style of player, but if you can prove that you're a more efficient number one type of option over the course of a long season, you have a better chance of leapfrogging yourself into that higher territory.
Yeah, no question. I'm trying to think, is there anything that you have concerns on Kugel?
Defensively, just kind of the fit on that end. I think 6'5 is a really tough spot to be in if you're not really quick at the point of attack and you're not super physical to guard up against different wings. It just kind of handcuffs whatever team you're playing on in the league to have different types of defensive personnel or schemes to help you. So it's more so about the natural tools than it is about if he can ever turn into a solid defender. He's just not very versatile.
Yep. No, I think that's really interesting as well. But he's strong. He's physical. He's like 200 pounds. Like he looks like a big dude out there for his size. Not like he's a well-built dude with like real body control, real physicality, physical, powerful athlete at 200 pounds. Has real defensive upside, I think. The other guy is Terrence Arsenault at Houston that I think I will have as a first-round pick entering next season, maybe not quite a lottery pick, but probably a first round pick. What do you like about Terrence Arsenault, a guy that we talked about quite a bit in the preseason, but didn't really kind of morph into a difference maker for Houston this season?
Yeah, I mean, I see him long term as a lockdown 3-and-D type of guy. And you don't go to a school like Houston and play for a coach like Calvin Sampson if you don't enjoy playing defense. So the fact that he chooses to go back confirms that he loves something about competing and being that bulldog kind of guy. I think having a different roster next year at Houston might allow him to get a few more touches on the offensive end with the ball in his hands, as well as show a little bit more defensive versatility. Agree that he needed more time, but I think the intrigue of how valuable guys like him are with his positional size, ability to shoot the basketball, and defensive aptitude, those guys do end up being valuable in the NBA. I think he, agree, would have been around a top 40 guy had he declared this year, but I do think going back to school will help him.
Yeah, I would have liked to have seen him in the pre-draft to feel any type of way about where he would have gone this year. He's a project at this point, but someone that I think is like a real project worth investing in long term. Like unequivocally, I think he's someone that I would like to know much, much more about, and that I think is really intriguing long term. Okay. The next guy here, I just want to talk about Providence in some way.
Yeah.
Two guys from Providence to decide to return that I think would have been certainly two-way guys, if not, you know, potential second round picks. Bryce Hopkins is the main guy that will get the, you know, attention, first team all Big East this past season. Averaged something like 16-8 in that ballpark, let's say. Shot limited attempts from three, but knocked down the ones that he took. Was very physical as a driver, was a mismatch nightmare in that Ed Cooley flex offense. We're going to get to see him, I think, in a little bit different of an offense next season under Kim English. Kim likes to space it out and try and, you know, drive and attack and play with like a well-spaced floor. Bryce Hopkins, I think, probably would have been a top 50 pick had he decided to come out. The guy that genuinely, like, I get a lot of feedback on from teams that have seen Providence a decent amount is Devin Carter. Devin Carter was one of the best perimeter defenders in college basketball this season. Just unequivocally, he is an absolute beast. He gets around screens. He's physical at the point of attack. He's strong. The offense is still developing. Like it's coming. Like he had a pretty okay season offensively, but it was lower use than you'd like to see. Like he averaged 13 points, 5 rebounds, and 2.5 assists, but he just can't shoot right now is the real problem. Like he shot 30% from three this season. If that improves, if the shooting part of his game improves, he's someone that you could see really move up and like make a name for himself as a really intriguing prospect that teams are fascinated in because the defense is as high level as it is.
You know, I mentioned with Arsenault the desire to buy in and play for a guy like Calvin Sampson. I think the same thing of anybody who chooses to go play for Ed Cooley, that you know what you're getting in terms of toughness and physicality and consistency that you've got to bring in on that end of the floor. And that's certainly where Carter pops as being one of the best guys that we've seen be an active, intense perimeter defender in the Ed Cooley era when he was at Providence. I'm curious to see if that translates over to another season. The Friars are doing really well right now. Kim English has kept a lot of important pieces in town. Garway Duel being another one with the recent kind of recommitment that he made to the Friars there, bringing some good guys from George Mason with him. The Big East is going to be really fun again next year. Really, really fun.
Yep. Yeah. So right now you're looking at, you know, the fact that Kim brought Justin Fernandez and Devontae Gaines in the backcourt. You know, they have Jaden Pierre in the backcourt as well. They bring in Garway Duel, who is the guy that I'm telling you, if you would have seen him in Hoop Summit practice, you would have thought this guy is like a potential one and done. He was long term. He was the guy that a lot of GMs and scouts that I talked to while I was just like sitting around there and having conversations and, you know, following up with after, he was the guy that they were like, man, like he really impressed us. Like he was, His defensive intensity was outrageous. Like, he was unbelievable with his hand-eye coordination, the way that he was able to pickpocket guys and really make it hard for them at the point of attack. And then offensively, he had some real shake moments. Like, yeah, he played with AJ Johnson in high school, earlier in his high school career. I think he's a better prospect than AJ Johnson. I do. Like, AJ Johnson just signed today in the NBL. I have some questions about how successful AJ will be in that setting next year. He's a very skinny kid right now. That we've seen how that goes in the NBL with guys that are quite skinny from Texas, you know, RJ Hampton, Terrence Ferguson, right? Previously, you know, it can be a bit difficult for those guys from time to time to really, really thrive at that level. Yeah. Right. So I'm going to be intrigued to see how it goes for him, but Garway, I think, is going to be well positioned in that backcourt at Providence to really play well, in my opinion.
Yeah. Friars are going to be good again. Ed Cooley moving to Georgetown. I think he's done a decent job reloading on the fly so far and bringing in the right guys for him and for the program. Like, the Big East with Rick Pitino joining again, it's in a really good spot. Donovan Klingon going back, you know, Marquette can still be really, really solid and strong next year. Villanova's got another year to continue to reload and do what they always do. The Big East is just so fun. So, so fun.
Yeah. No, it's going to be a great league again. Oh, look at Georgetown. Adams' beloved Hoyas ready to go. You know, Baylor Shireman also, you know, a guy that's going back to Creighton next year in the Big East. Really interesting decision, I thought. You know, he was someone that was expected to just to be there for 1 year at Creighton, but did have the second year. You know, being home, he's from the state of Nebraska, if I remember correctly, originally. And, you know, sometimes home is where the heart is. And I'm sure Creighton is taking care of him in terms of the NIL market, just given the fact that, you know, he committed there as a transfer last year when all of this really exploded. Yeah. So, you know, I think he'd have been on a two-way next year for sure. And maybe might have made slightly more than what he'll make at Creighton. But, you know, home is happiness, right? And, you know, good for Baylor if he decides he wants to try and make a run at a Final Four next year.
Yeah, and again, the NIL is the game changer here. It makes it more tenable for guys who are freshmen and not sure if they're going to be a first-round pick to come back. It also makes it more tenable for upperclassmen to just see out the rest of their career, enjoy their glory days in college, and know that those two-way spots and ability to earn their way onto an NBA roster are probably going to be there for them down the line as well.
Is there anyone else you want to point out?
You know, I saw, correct me if I'm wrong, Trevin Brazil at Arkansas is going back for another year.
He is, yeah.
He missed the end of the season and a large chunk of time due to injury. I was really impressed by him, the activity level on the defensive end of the floor, the addition of a jump shot to his game as like a freak athlete, 6'8", 6'9", kind of guy. Curious to see what he looks like on the must-bust next year, because we know their roster is always going to reload through the transfer portal, but keeping him to come back is a really good move for the Razorbacks. And he's another curious guy for me of if he has a really strong, solid year next year, could float himself up into that first round range.
Yeah. Just some, you know, guys we're waiting on decisions from, you know, Zach Edey is one, certainly. Yeah. Jolas Tubelis is another one that we're waiting on a decision from. You know, Oscar Shibwe, it seems like, is testing the waters right now. We'll see whether or not he returns. I frankly have no idea what the UCLA guys are doing. Jalen Clark just like said, I declare draft, and like didn't say what he's doing, whether or not he's testing the waters or going 2 feet in, it feels like, you know, in terms of maintaining his eligibility. Same with Amari Bailey today. Like, there's no real clarity, it feels like, there. And this is me saying I don't know what they're doing. This isn't me saying that they have made a decision one way or another. I just don't know based off of the information at hand. Adem Bona is another one. Really great example of someone that we're really waiting on information from. I don't think I've seen Oso Igodaro make a decision yet, but Marquette is another team that, you know, could have everybody come back and could be in a really positive position moving forward. You know, I'm trying to think, like, Ryan Kalkbrenner is another name that, you know, really, really high level name that could end up going back to school and really morphing Creighton from, you know, where they were this year to a top 10 team next season. I believe that Michigan State's backcourt, Tyson Walker and AJ Hogard, like, have decided to return. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think, is there anybody else that we really, really have missed?
Has Julian Phillips made a decision?
I don't think I've seen Julian Phillips make a decision yet. You know, Armando Bacot's made a decision. I don't think Kobe Brown has officially decided anything yet. You know, I'm trying to think who else. Yeah,
Jordan Walsh, that feels... decision at Arkansas.
Yeah, Jordan Walsh. Sorry, I missed. Yeah, my brain failed. I've not seen Jordan Walsh's decision, to be sure, either. So, you know, could be a guy that would be very, it'd be very interesting to know a lot about what Arkansas looks like with Jordan Walsh, Khalif Battle, and many of the other guys that they have there.
Well, and look, the other strange part of this with the transfer portal and so much movement that goes on is the guys that are testing the waters find themselves in difficult positions because you never know when the right time is to pull the trigger on coming back if that's a decision that you make. You may find yourself out of an opportunity behind you or losing some of the comfort and the same role that you expected to have for year two at your college program if you wait too long to drag out that process. So this is going to be an evolving thing we see over the next several years with the fluidity of declaring and testing the waters and then having to make the decision for when to withdraw. But I think of the top 45-ish guys, those are the only ones that that I still don't think we've heard from.
Yep. Okay, I think that's all we got, Spins. Do you have anything else you need to get off your chest before we get out of here?
I don't think so. Succession is awesome. I'm glad to have that back in my life. That's about
it. Are you caught up?
I have to watch the most recent one, episode 3. I haven't gotten yet, but the first two were awesome.
Cool. I will avoid any comment at all. So, yeah, no, I'm excited. Succession is back. I'm excited that I'm here in LA. Like I said, I had a great few days going around talking to draft prospects. It's been great to be back here, getting a chance to meet with some of those people. You know, I do know a lot of agents watch the show. Like, please, by all means, anybody that you want to send my way, I would love to, you know, talk to and would love to, you know, get to know them a little bit better. So please send them my way. Would be more than happy to talk to them. Let's see. That's about it, man. That's all I've got. I'm pretty wiped. I'm out here in LA and it's going to be a beautiful few days while I'm still out here.
Enjoy some of the weather and the beach while you're out there too, Sam, will you?
I absolutely will, man. Adam, please tell the people where they can find your work. Tell the people what's going on in your life.
Yeah, follow me on Twitter at @TheBoxAndOne_. YouTube, my channel is Adam Spinella, or the Substack, TheBoxAndOne.substack.com. Just put out Jordan Hawkins and Grady Dick scouting report videos with the Grady Dick scout written form. Coming out here just before the weekend, but Portsmouth is really what's coming up this weekend. Really looking forward to heading down there and diving head first into seeing a bunch of the great upperclassmen that we have. Always one or two guys who ends up, you know, rising from there and ends up either getting drafted or being actually an impact player early in their career. So I'm very fascinated to get my eyes on this year's field.
Love it. I'm so excited. We'll talk about that maybe on Monday, maybe, you know, Sunday. Sure. We'll see whenever, you know, whenever you're around again. The problem with next week is that I fly back to Australia on Monday, US time. I will lose a day basically traveling back. And then Sunday is my birthday actually. So we will see whether or not I decide to record a podcast on my birthday. But, Adam, this is all I've got for you, man. This is all I've got for the people as well. I've got a bunch of newsers up on The Athletic breaking down bunch of decisions, AJ Johnson, Donovan Klingon, you know, X, Y, and Z, just looking through what I've written recently, Cam Whitmore, Walter Clayton, Khalil Ware, Bronny James. We did like a little breakdown on him. So quite a bit of stuff over on the website. Please go rate, review, subscribe to this show, subscribe over on YouTube, the Game Theory Podcast with Sam Vecini. Please go search that out. That's all I've got, man. Until next time, we'll talk soon. Bye.